The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 7th, 2020. It is a not quite emergency edition, but an almost emergency-ish edition, and we don't usually do election coverage on the Lawfare Podcast or on Lawfare, but we do do election security and election meltdown coverage, and that is what we're doing today because of the mess in Iowa. Coincides with the landing on my desk of a book called Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy by the great law professor Richard Hassan, who joins me by the magic of telephonic communications. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
So the first question I have for you is, how much did you pay the Iowa Democratic Party to give such an incredible proof of concept to your book?
Yeah, well, it was a little crazy when Tuesday morning election meltdown came out, and we had an actual election meltdown in Iowa. And, you know, it's great for marketing, terrible for the country. When my phone is ringing off the hook, as has been all week, it means that we're in trouble.
That's sort of the slogan of Lawfare. If it's bad, it's good for us.
Yeah, well, yeah, we've, you know, focusing on disaster has its rewards, but I would rather be in a different line of business that gives a different kind of reward.
Exactly. So to be clear, this book came out this week as the ongoing meltdown was happening in the Iowa caucuses. Is that right?
Yeah. So the Iowa caucuses were on Monday and the book officially came out on Tuesday.
Right. You know, I have not read the entire book yet. It's only having been in my presence briefly. But I was flipping through it today, and what you seem to be describing in the book is a confluence of factors that cumulatively can lead to an election meltdown. One of those factors, and the place I'd like to start, is the incompetence and failures of state and local election administration officials. So let's start by situating what happened in Iowa in the context of the argument that you make in the book, and then we can broaden out from there to some of the other factors that are at issue that you discuss in the book.
Sure. And I should say all the factors I discuss in Election Meltdown in the first four chapters are reasons why Americans' trust in the fairness and legitimacy of the election process is going down, and why the kind of peaceful transitions of power and losers accepting election results, as we've had in this country for a long time, is under strain and a guess. And so one of the factors, as you mentioned, is incompetence. So I should start off by saying that most election administrators do a really good job with some inadequate resources in running what is a pretty complicated thing to run an election with so many people coming at the same day to try to do this activity, relying on volunteer workers in the polls and all of that. But there are the weak links, and I offer what I call the weakest link axiom of elections, which is that in the event of a very close election, everyone's focus is going to be on those weak links, because that's where it's possible to try to flip the results of an election. That's where we might see that the election doesn't reflect the will of the people. The Iowa caucuses were a great wake-up call, but they are atypical in that they were run not by Iowa election officials who run general elections, but they were run by the Iowa Democratic Party, doing this once every 4 years. And that, you know, alone is a reason for worry, given that just about every caucus season, we have one or two meltdowns because the volunteers working for the parties don't know what they're doing. But things were compounded here because the Iowa Democratic Party rolled out both new technology in the form of an app, a smartphone app that was supposed to be used for reporting results, as well as new rules. Rather than reporting one number, three numbers were being reported, and there were all kinds of questions about even their computation. And so, you know, really the Iowa situation demonstrates what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't have amateurs running a process. You shouldn't roll out new equipment in a major election, right? This is the only time the whole world is paying attention to Iowa every 4 years. And then they compounded things. What you shouldn't do is release your vote totals after you've been late in dribs and drabs and then have to issue corrections off along the way. You should be making sure everything is triple checked and transparent about what went wrong and what you've done to fix it. And we saw none of that in this fiasco.
All right. So this seems like a churlish question to ask somebody who just happens to have written a book called Election Meltdown that's released literally as an election meltdown is unfolding. But one thought I had is that the election meltdowns that you're imagining and describing are actually quite different from, a state party screwing up a caucus, right? And this is a kind of an outlying residue process. And it doesn't really indicate that maybe that we should be particularly worried about whether the vote in Kansas or in South Florida is going to be correctly tabulated in a timely fashion in November by actual local officials using actual ballots rather than the kind of hand tabulated sort of Stone Age stuff that the Iowa Democratic Party insists on using. So I guess the question is, how generalizable is this problem, and is the Iowa experience this year a kind of wake-up call that people, is it an example of a wake-up call that people should really be taking this problem seriously, or is it a sui generis example of Iowa being a weird outlier in the way it chooses to conduct primary elections?
Well, I think it's both, right? It's an outlier in that it's the party running the election and it's got these convoluted rules. But it is an exemplar of the fact that things can go wrong. And obviously, I wrote Election Meltdown before Iowa. Some of the examples I give in there have to do with Broward County, Florida. And the election administrator there, Brenda Snipes, who had been in office for years of mess-ups, including in one election forgetting to send 58,000 absentee ballots to people who had requested them, in another election leaving a medical marijuana initiative off the ballot, in another election reporting results too early, in another election destroying ballots before the 22-month period that federal law requires that they be preserved, and then just really messing up in a recount in a very close race in 2018 between Rick Scott running the governor of Florida running for Senate against Bill Nelson. And they had to do a recount because it was so close. And the Broward County officials did not get the new vote totals included in the recount because they were too late in submitting them by 2 minutes because they did not know how to interact with the state website. And I give examples of Democrats and Republicans engaging in problematic election administration activity. Again, it's not the average, but there's enough of it to go around. I talk about the Detroit meltdown when they tried to recount the 2016 votes in the presidential race when Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, requested it. I talk about in Georgia, Brian Kemp, who engaged in just he tried to cover up his misadministration of the voter registration database of the state when it was found to be vulnerable by falsely accusing the Democratic Party of hacking into the system and posting that on the state's official Secretary of State website 3 days before the election when Georgia voters are going to that site to find out where to vote. I mean, there's just tons of examples just from 2016 and 2018 of foul-ups by both parties in how they're counting actual votes in an actual election, not a party doing it in a caucus.
Your book is broader than this kind of, incompetent and machine screw up local official problem. It deals with a bunch of broader issues. And the thesis, as I understand it, seems to be that some combination of those factors has some substantial chance of leading to a real meltdown in the context of, I think you're really thinking of a U.S. presidential election. So step back out of the Iowa example for a minute and give us an overview of what the major factors are that make you and less confident than you would like to be that the results of an election will A, be knowable and B, be accepted.
Sure. And just like if you ran a nuclear power plant, you would take extraordinary steps to avert a catastrophe, even if it's a low risk catastrophe. I would say the same thing here. I'm not saying it's likely that we're going to have a meltdown in 2020. Lots of things would have to happen for a presidential election to melt down. The problems would have to be, for example, in a state that is crucial to the electoral college outcome. But it's possible to imagine one of those happening. One thing we saw in Iowa was the late results really caused people to get very upset. We had a CNN negative countdown clock as the results were late. Well, Pennsylvania is moving to a new system of allowing no excuse absentee balloting. We're going to have a flood of absentee ballots. We're already told there, and also in Michigan, that it might be days to count the votes. We also know from some social science evidence in other states that these late counting votes come in and they tend to be Democratic. And so we had a lot of races in California in 2018 where they started off with Republicans in the lead, ended up with Democrats. It's not hard to imagine Trump trying to claim victory on election night in Pennsylvania only to see his lead evaporate. And so, with claims of voter fraud, as he did in 2018 in that Rick Scott, Bill Nelson race, where he said, you have to go with election night because the later counted ballots are, he said, quote, massively infected, which was a lie. So kind of backing up a little bit, I see these four factors as contributing to the potential for a meltdown. One we've already talked about is incompetence. Another is false claims of voter fraud, which often leads to laws that are passed by Republican legislatures that make it harder for people to register and vote. These convince Republicans that Democrats are cheating with voter fraud and convince Democrats that Republicans are cheating through voter suppression. There's also dirty tricks, right? So it's both the newfangled stuff we saw from the Russians in 2016, the manipulation of social media, the stealing and dumping of documents, political documents, as well as the probing of voter registration databases. But there's also the potential for old-fashioned dirty tricks, as we saw in the North Carolina 9th Congressional District in 2018, where you had a political operative engaged in tampering with absentee ballots, potentially swinging the result there. It was so bad that the bipartisan North Carolina State Board of Elections had to call a new election, had to have a do-over, which is hard to do. And then the fourth factor, so you've got the voter fraud, voter suppression issue, you've got incompetence, you've got dirty tricks. And the last thing is the increasingly incendiary rhetoric about stolen and rigged elections, which I think undermines people's confidence, believing that this is a common occurrence. Indeed, it was Trump's campaign manager just hours into the Iowa Democratic Party meltdown claiming that it was a rigged election and lots of people saying it was stolen. You had outside forces, you had bots trying to magnify these claims. And it's just all of these put together, you can imagine when we get to November 2020, there's going to be something like 47, 48% of the population that's going to be extremely unhappy, at least that percentage, is going to be extremely unhappy with the results of the election. And it's very tempting to believe that if your side lost, your side that is true and right, it was not because the other side got more votes in those electoral college states, but that there was cheating going on. And so I worry that we're going to have a problem with the transition if, you know, Trump loses, and we're going to have a problem potentially with Democrats accepting the result if Trump is reelected.
How much of this is a Donald Trump problem, and how much of it is not a Donald Trump problem? I mean, his name came up repeatedly in the answer to that last question, and yet you've been warning about a lot of these issues for a lot of years, most of which were before Donald Trump burst on the national scene. And so, like, do you understand this as a set of problems that Trump is essentially symptomatic of? Is he exacerbating, or is he the cause of?
I think exacerbating is where I would put it. That is, we've had these issues before, but never have you had a president or a major presidential candidate engaging in such fear-mongering and lying about how an election took place, and also breaking norms. And let me give examples of each. In the 2016 election, where Trump was victorious, he lost the popular vote by about 3 million votes. And then he came out and told ABC's David Muir that there were 3 to 5 million illegal votes, non-citizen votes, cast in the election, a claim that is utterly without any basis in reality. And yet he goes around all the time saying that there's massive fraud, voter fraud going on in elections, for which there is no proof. Trump has also broken norms. And an example is the fact that he has joked or remarked, and I'll put jokes in quotes, he's joked or remarked about staying in office beyond his constitutional term, 12 more years, 16 more years, at least 28 times. I had a piece in Slate earlier this week with a spreadsheet of the 27 times he had done it. And since then, after he was acquitted in the impeachment vote, he tweeted out yet another one showing Trump 2024, Trump 2028, et cetera. So Trump is a symptom rather than the disease, but he's also throwing gasoline on a fire that's already raging and, you know, making it more hyper-polarized, and I think further undermining the kind of norms and values that we need for people to accept election results, to say, okay, we fought a good fight, our side lost, we'll come back in the next election season and we'll try and convince people that we should win this time.
I don't want to engage in whataboutism, but what about the Democratic side of this, where there is, seems to me, a little bit more, it's a bit of a more complicated story, because voter suppression efforts, as you describe in the book, really are real. On the other hand, the effort to, for example, insist that Stacey Abrams would have won but for what happened in Georgia strikes me as very difficult to support empirically. And so you see on the Democratic side a kind of combination of a legitimate objection, set of objections and anger toward genuine voter suppression efforts, combined with a very eager willingness to read them as more consequential than we know or understand them or can document that they really are. In addition, you have a whole lot of rhetoric on the side of the, particularly in the Bernie Sanders camp, that simply does not seem to accept that Hillary Clinton, for example, won the primary the last time around, and does not really accept the possibility that Bernie Sanders could lose absent skullduggery. Is this an asymmetric situation, or is this a situation in which the same things are happening with different modalities on both sides of the political spectrum?
Well, I think it is more asymmetric than symmetrical in terms of the parties. Republicans are out there much more often talking about stolen and rigged elections than Democrats. But you're right about the Stacey Abrams example. Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, said that, you know, with Stacey Abrams losing to Brian Kemp, the election was stolen. And you remember that Abrams herself refused to recognize Kemp as the, quote, legitimate governor of Georgia. And I think it's a very fine line to walk. I have an extensive discussion in that chapter of this problem. One of my claims to fame is that I was attacked by Alec Baldwin for writing a piece in Slate saying, "Don't call the election stolen." I think we can say that Kemp engaged in disgusting voter suppression. He tried to manipulate the outcome, but according to the best social science I've seen, and according to an analysis by PolitiFact, there is no evidence that the things that he did, like the purges and the exact match requirement for voting, that these things actually affected the outcome of the election. And I think it's really problematic for Democrats to say the election was stolen, because it invites just the criticism that you were raising, which is prove it. And I think the focus should instead be on the question of the dignity of each voter. Why should Georgia be able to pass laws that make it harder to register and to vote when there's no proof that these laws are required in order to prevent voter fraud, and they seem to be motivated by trying to hurt Democratic turnout? So even if they're not able to do that, that seems to be their intention. So it really is a fine line. I think it's fine to call Brian Kemp a vote suppressor, and it's fine to say that his intent is bad, and I believe those things. But the right thing to do, and what Stacey Abrams did after she lost the election, is she brought a massive lawsuit against Georgia saying the combination of these things is aimed at suppressing the vote. She's gone to the courts, and she's formed a political organization that is trying to fight back against these repressive things. I think that's better than using rhetoric that says that the election was stolen, which can undermine everyone's confidence in the process and can actually be demobilizing and get people not to go vote, because, you know, why vote if you think that the situation is already rigged?
How big a problem is actual voter fraud? Your book begins with Trump being asked about that rare case, which is an actual documented incident of, you know, actual fraudulent voting in a North Carolina congressional district, and his being unwilling to address it because the voter fraud was on behalf of a congressional Republican candidate, not votes on behalf of his competition. The general response to voter fraud suggestions is that those are themselves a form of efforts at voter suppression, because in fact the problem of voter fraud doesn't really exist. So what is the most neutral, fair way to account for the fight between the voter suppression and the voter fraud worlds?
So what I would say is that I actually start the book after the vignette that's in the introduction. I start chapter one of the book with what I consider to be the most important voting rights trial of the 21st century, one that most people who are listening probably have not heard of. It's a case called Fish versus Kobach. Chris Kobach, the former Secretary of State of Kansas, notorious for making unsubstantiated voter fraud claims. This was a case where it's kind of a complicated legal situation, but what was at issue in this trial was how much non-citizen voter fraud is there, non-citizens registering and voting, and how much do laws that require documentary proof of citizenship before registering to vote, which Kansas had, laws that say you have to produce a birth certificate or a naturalization certificate in order to be able to register to vote, how much do they actually suppress the vote? And in this trial, what we found out was that about 30,000 people had their voter registration suspended because they didn't meet the show me your papers law. So that's a real suppressive effect of this law. Those people were not going to be allowed to vote until the court issued an injunction requiring that they be registered. That much more than we see with a lot of these voter ID laws, where I think Democrats do tend to exaggerate the extent to which these laws actually affect turnout. On the other side of the ledger, Kobach was able to produce virtually no evidence of non-citizen voting in Texas. In fact, it was kind of laughable that one of the studies that he relied on from a political science expert that he retained looked at the 30,000 people on that list, and he and his graduate assistant, this expert, his graduate assistant, coded whether or not they had foreign-sounding names to try to figure out how many non-citizens were on the rolls. And so you had the ACLU's Dale Ho cross-examining this expert and asking him, if you saw the name Carlos Murguia on the list, would you code that as foreign or non-foreign? And they go back and forth a bit. And he says, yeah, probably foreign. And then Dale Ho comes back with, are you aware that Carlos Murguia is a judge in this courthouse? And, you know, it was just kind of laughable. In the end, Federal District Court Chief Judge in Kansas, Julie Robinson, concluded there was no iceberg. You know, it wasn't the tip of the iceberg. There was only an icicle made up mostly of administrative error. And so I think, talk about an asymmetry. There is virtually no evidence of massive voter fraud. When it does happen, it tends to happen with absentee ballots. And I give that example from the North Carolina 9th District, which was fraud on voters. They had their ballots stolen or changed, not fraud by voters. Very rare, does happen occasionally, but lots of attempts to make it harder to register and vote. Sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not. But the motivation for these laws appears not to prevent voter fraud, but to try to skew the electorate in a way that would help a Republican Party that is increasingly relying upon a rural, a white minority of voters.
So I ask this question as somebody who was once on the DC voting rolls twice, once as Benjamin Wittes, registered Democrat, and once as Benjamin Sittis, registered independent. And the this result happened when I joined the Washington Post editorial board and decided I should not be a registered with a political party because the Post masthead said an independent newspaper, and so I thought I should re-register as an independent. And so went to the next time I renewed my driver's license, I went in and under motor voter, you know, just told them to redo my registration. And instead of changing my registration, they simply added a new voter to the rolls. Benjamin Sittis lived at my house. He, I got his mail sometimes, and he never voted. And so my question is, how big a problem is it that there are lots of Benjamin Sittises out there, people who are former, you know, accidentally on the rolls, people who are on the rolls but then die and stay on the rolls, people who are on the rolls and move away. And some states have millions of extra voters, presumably who are not mostly showing up and voting. That lots of states, particularly with Republican legislatures and governors seem to think it's very important to scrub kind of energetically. What is the bigger problem, the effort to scrub these voters or the presence of these voters in the first place?
So I think that what you've described is a common problem, and it's, again, a problem of incompetence, not a problem of fraud. You may remember back in, I guess it would be 2008, the Acorn scandal. This is when John McCain is running for president there. Acorn was paying all of these people to register voters and got paid by the number of registrations. So Mickey Mouse got registered a lot and Tony Romo got registered a lot. You know, you heard all of these notorious stories, rampant voter fraud, but it turns out Tony Romo, I don't know if he voted once, but he didn't vote thousands of times, nor did Mickey Mouse show up at the polls. And I'm guessing no one ever voted the name of Benjamin Sittis because they wouldn't know that. And also, if you were trying to create a conspiracy where you were going to steal an election, trying to find people and have them go to the polling place to pretend to be someone else and then have pay them, but have them vote in a secret ballot where you can't figure out who is who they're actually voting for, and do this in large enough numbers to swing an election. I mean, that sounds really boneheaded, which is why you almost never see this kind of fraud going on. And yet, I think the fact that we have places where there are thousands of people who have not yet been removed from the rolls is problematic in terms of voter confidence, because it allows people who want to stir the pot to say, look at how bloated these voter rolls are, more voters listed than people and all of that. So we do need to clean the voting rolls. And there's some good news here, which is that there's a consortium of states that are sharing information. So it's a consortium called ERIC, which is sharing information electronically of people who moved and died, and so that states can you know, if somebody moves from New Jersey to Minnesota, there'll be a notification now. Minnesota knows that this person's coming in. New Jersey knows to take the person off. And so there are things that are being done to clean things up. But, you know, again, it's the weakest link problem. Some of the places that have the biggest problems, you know, are with running elections generally have these bloated voter rolls. Often it's big Democratic cities. And this brings me to kind of a broader point. It's a point I make in, I have a piece in tomorrow's Wall Street Journal in the Saturday essay. People who live in big cities administered by Democrats sometimes face what I call a double whammy. First, they've got poor election administration, which is sometimes because of underfunding and sometimes because of incompetence. And then Republicans turn around and accuse the people who live there of committing voter fraud because so many things go wrong. It can't just be a coincidence. It's got to be that someone's trying to steal the election. So I think both things matter, right? So it's important to have rules that allow people to be fairly registered to vote, but it's also important to have good administrative practices so that we don't have bloat and things that people can point to say that the system is being run in a shoddy way that allows for the potential for fraud.
All right. So the third area that you really focus on in the book is dirty tricks. And, you know, we're all very sensitive that to that because of the Russian intervention in the 2016 election. But you make the, I think, clearly correct argument that this is not simply a problem of foreign intervention. There's a, you know, domestic not playing fair aspect of it as well. So how this is obviously not what happened in Iowa, at least not that we have any indication of, but how do you understand the relationship between voter suppression and local incompetence and this area of malicious activity, whether foreign or domestic?
Well, you know, so dirty tricks have been around as long as we've had elections. It's just that now it's somewhat easier to do these dirty tricks because of social media. And so I tell the story in the book of the 2017 U.S. Senate race to replace Jeff Sessions when he became Attorney General between Democrat Doug Jones and Republican Roy Moore, the controversial leader there. Some pro-Jones forces, without Jones' knowledge or cooperation, decided to try Russian-style tactics of trying to manipulate social media to get votes away from Jones. For example, they set up a site called Dry Alabama, which was meant to be some fundamentalist Baptists who believed that all alcohol should be banned in the state of Alabama. And they were supporting Roy Moore, supposedly. You know, these were liberal Democrats running this, pretending that they were Baptists. The goal, we know from some leaked documents, was to try to convince about 50,000 moderate Republicans to stay home to try to swing the election. As with the Russians, we don't know how much the social media manipulation mattered to the outcome. Chances are it didn't actually swing the election. But I think one of the things it does do is increase public cynicism about elections. And the other thing, when we see false information, and we saw the Russians send out a lot of false information, we saw this with the Iowa caucuses that it was rigged. When you see that, I think what ends up happening is that people tend to believe everything they see online is false. And Brendan Nyhan has done some very good work here, that what's happening with these dirty tricks is that it increases people's cynicism and inability to tell what's true from what's false. And so in that way, it creates a general corrosive effect on our democracy, that where we don't have that active alert citizenry that needs to be, you know, able to get accurate information to make decisions. Instead, we're being swayed by emotions and being manipulated by foreign and domestic sources. And so that is really troubling.
We've already talked a little bit about divisive rhetoric and delegitimizing rhetoric, but I want to come back to it because it seems to me in this environment where we are this polarized, this actually has a lot of potential, even in the context of an election that is, you know, wholly fairly administered and not reasonably subject to challenge, to generate a lot of you know, kind of delegitimization of the of the result in either direction. And I guess my question is, what's the right way to deal with that as a society, especially considering that, and I'll perhaps reveal one of my own biases here, that one of our major networks is actively in the business of promoting exactly this kind of rhetoric, even apparently as we've recently learned over the strident analysis of some of its own staff.
Well, I think it's problematic. And long-term solutions, one of them is increased civics education so that people are alert as to the need for fair elections and the need for losers to accept the results of fair elections and fight another day. Saying civics education, I mean, that's really a long-term project. I think the best thing that we can do in the short term is try to fix the other areas I've talked about, like recognizing that the voter fraud, voter suppression debate is essentially over and there is no major voter fraud in this country. I think that message should, you know, be made loud and clear. I think we need to root out the most incompetent election administrators and make sure that there's adequate funding for our elections. We need to have increased, you know, cybersecurity measures. One of the things I'm worried about is an attack on the electrical grid in a democratic city like Detroit or Milwaukee in a swing state on election day. You know, we need to have plan B. You know, Norm Ornstein's been working on these kind of continuity of government issues and, you know, a terrorist attack or a natural disaster hitting on election day. We don't have good procedures in place. The more we can do things on the front end, the less opportunity there will be for people to be taken in by those outside agitators or inside agitators who will try to spread misinformation and try and delegitimize the process. And the media has a big role to play here. One of the things I want to see the media doing in advance of the election is pounding the message that it may be days or even weeks before we know who the president is, and that's okay. That's not a sign of fraud. That's a sign that election administrators are being careful in counting the ballots and making sure that things are done accurately. And election administrators, more than anyone else, need to be extremely transparent about what their rules and procedures are. They need to make it so it's clear, and so that conspiracy theories about boxes of ballots left in someone's trunk, that these kinds of things are not going to be provable. They're not going to be accurate, and so that, you know, then that will help at least mitigate the kinds of claims that are made when you can point to actual evidence and show that the conspiracy theories are not true.
This point you make about it being acceptable and even appropriate for it to take a long time to count ballots, I have two questions about that. The first is there are certain states, one of them being the potential swing state of Arizona, that are kind of known to have very long ballot counting times. And I guess my question is that reasonable federalism, or is that some states simply having less good procedures for this than others? In other words, is it should we take the view toward Arizona, which, you know, really does take weeks to you know, finish up a close election, should we take the position that that's kind of federalism in action, and if that's the way they want to do it, that's fine? Or should we take the view of it that, you know, gosh, there is legitimacy costs to taking that long, and we should really harmonize procedures toward best and fastest practices here?
Well, I'm a general believer in a larger federal role in elections. I would actually move to national nonpartisan election administration like we do in Canada, like we do in Australia, UK, Germany. But I don't think this particular problem that you're flagging would necessarily be solved by moving to a more national model. And that's because some of the delay is because of resources, and I suppose that could be equalized if we had federal elections, although my guess is it would be slower everywhere based on, you know, how the federal government generally does things. But also, if you're processing absentee ballots, that and you're dealing with a large population, that can take a long time. So, you know, California, it takes weeks and weeks because you have to check the absentee ballot envelopes to make sure that people have, you know, followed the rules and they've verified who they are and all of that. We want those procedures to be right. I think the answer to this is not to make the counting faster, although if we can make it faster and keep it accurate, I'm all for it, but to educate the public that this takes time. Aside from going to war and conducting the census, this is probably the hardest thing we do together as a country, you know, every 4 years. And so that people need to understand patience. They need to understand that this is a tremendous undertaking to do this in a 1 day or 2 week period. It's just crazy times in an election administrator's office under the best of circumstances, especially if you're talking about a place like Phoenix or a place like Detroit. You know, to pick a big city, there's going to be lots and lots of ballots, lots of things to check, and people who show up and maybe they're not properly registered to vote and they're going to put in a provisional ballot. And maybe ultimately that ballot's not going to be counted because they're not eligible to vote or they vote in the wrong place. But it takes time to figure that out. And so I think we need to learn patience, and better to get it right than to do it fast. And as we saw in Iowa, have said, oops, you know, we released some results, but they're actually wrong. So here's some new results. You don't want that. That is a more of a way of undermining people's confidence in the process.
So the flip side of that same question is maybe the problem with our response to Iowa was our own expectations that we were going to get answers Monday evening. And maybe we put that expectation put so much pressure on people in Iowa that the administrators in Iowa and the Iowa Democratic Party that they made hasty decisions and bad decisions. Was the right answer when there was a glitch in the system or a sequence of glitches in the system for us all to have been like, okay, let's go to bed and, you know, we'll get the results Wednesday or Thursday?
Well, it's all about expectation setting. I think if Iowa Democratic Party officials said, listen, it's going to take us 2 days, have patience, we have a new system, we have a new app, this is what we're doing, and we're transparent about it, then, you know, I think people, many more people would have accepted that. I mean, there would have still been the conspiracy theories. What are you hiding? What are you doing? But I think if you explained what was going on in a clear and transparent way, that would be fine. Instead, what the Iowa Democratic Party did was, I can't remember exactly what time it was, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night, they released a statement saying there were, quote, quality control issues, which, you know, sounds like corporate speak for some kind of snafu that's not being adequately explained. They weren't transparent. And so, and you know, they knew there were problems. They knew the smartphone app was not properly vetted. They knew that people in the precincts did not even know, some of them didn't even know how to download it. And then there's, I don't know how this happened, but the phone number for precinct captains to call in information to the Iowa Democratic Party appeared on TV. And then you had Trump supporters calling on those phone lines. You know, if this were a concerted effort, it could even potentially be illegal. But at the very least, you know, this is not a phone number that you in any way make publicly available. So it's just like a series of self-inflicted wounds by the Iowa Democratic Party. And then you had Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, yesterday saying that there should be a re-canvass, you know, checking the vote totals again for the whole state, and then saying, no, I didn't mean that. So I just think it's hard to imagine how they could have handled this worse than they've handled it this week.
So we have a few questions from Twitter, one of which is a great one to close on. But before we get to that, here is a question from Jennifer Cohn. Hi, what are Rick's thoughts and advice regarding Georgia's controversial new universal use QR code ballot marking devices and the state's rushed/behind-schedule attempted deployment of them? Thanks. Do you know anything about what Georgia's doing with QR code ballots?
Yes. So yeah, this is the big hot issue right now in the field of voting machines. So you know, lots of states are getting rid of the generation of voting machines that they brought in after the 2000 debacle. And they're replacing them. So they were initially replaced with machines after 2000 with machines that some of them didn't produce a piece of paper at all, which is very problematic because you can't really do a recount on that. So the new machines that are being rolled out in Georgia and elsewhere are ballot marking devices or BMDs. These machines, you get to vote on a touchscreen. We're going to have this in Los Angeles as well. You vote on a touchscreen, but then the machine prints a ballot for you. And on the ballot, it'll list, you know, it'll say Ben Wittes, and it'll list, you know, not it'll say, you know, Ben Wittes for president, you know, it'll list the names of the candidates or ballot measures you voted on. And then it'll also have a barcode or a QR code. And when the machines are, when the ballots are being counted, the machines that count the ballots will be reading that QR code or reading the barcode as opposed to reading the name, you know, Ben Wittes for president that's printed on the ballot. So there are really two problems with that have been flagged about these BMDs. One problem, which some computer scientists have flagged, is If you're not marking it on paper with, you know, like a number two pencil and filling in an optical scan, the way people vote in lots of places in the country, you might not check your ballot, and the machine could be hacked or programmed to print a different name on the ballot. You know, I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not sure how much of a concern that is, you know, how many people will check that and find errors. So that's one issue. And you know, that has to be balanced against the benefit of a system where it's you can program in multiple languages. These machines are good for people with disabilities and all of that. So you know, I think I'm uncertain as to how to balance that. But the other issue, and the one that I think your reader was mentioning, is suppose that there's a recount. What is going to count as the official vote? Is it going to be the barcode, or is it going to be the name that's printed on the ballot? It's important that it be the name that's printed on the ballot, because otherwise it's possible that someone messes with the coding that counts those barcodes or QR codes, and it's not accurate. So what we need to do is be able to have a post-election audit where we can compare the totals that come from the scanning that the computer does with a hand recount of, you know, a portion of the ballots, to make sure that if it says that Ben Wittes for president got 42%, that's exactly what we get with the hand recount. Georgia is apparently deciding that the barcode is the legal vote, and it doesn't matter, and we're not going to look at, and it would not control if you had a disparity, the barcode wins. And it seems to me that's really a recipe for disaster in terms of people's ability to be confident that their votes are being fairly and accurately counted. You and I can't read a barcode. We can't look at it and know if it's accurate. And so I think that is generally a problematic way of conducting an election, regardless of the larger question about using these machines in an election.
A question from Roy Pardee. He says, I always bristle a bit when I hear Rick cite incompetence on the part of poll workers and administrators. Is it possible that counting votes is more difficult than most people expect? Maybe fallible is a fairer word. Are you being too harsh when you say incompetence?
I don't think so. I mean, everybody makes mistakes. I make mistakes. The important thing when you make a mistake is being transparent about it and fixing your errors. What I'm talking about when I talk about in the book Election Meltdown are really egregious errors that are not corrected. So even after Brenda Snipes was found to have totally botched the 2018 recount, this is when she submitted the vote totals too late. It was such a bad recount that it counted 2,040 fewer votes than in the initial count, and the county board decided they would submit the original numbers rather than the recounted numbers because they thought that submitting the recounted numbers would disenfranchise more people. And despite all of this and other problems, like she would not even tell the Rick Scott campaign how many ballots were left to be counted when they were in the middle of the count, which is kind of a basic transparency thing you should be doing. Snipes was completely unrepentant and said, you know, we're not perfect. We're doing the best job we can. Well, if this is the best job you can do, you should find another line of work. And I really think, yes, people make mistakes, but when there's a constant level of problems, that's when it's time to say, this person should not be in this job. And I'd say the same thing about Brian Kemp and the years and years of problems and lawsuits over his failure to maintain security over the state's voter registration database. They said the problems were all fixed. And then still in 2018, a computer software person was able, with just a few keystrokes, when he was checking his own voter registration information, to download every file that was on the state's servers. So it's just on the state's voter registration server. So there, I would say, yeah, we're all fallible, but there's a level of basic competence, just like we expect of doctors and others, we should expect that of election officials.
Finally, one last question from Twitter from Mary Jane Hutchings, who asks, as an Iowan, was my night spent at the caucus a waste of time? This seems like a good question on which to end. What do we have to say to Iowans? Caucusing is time intensive. It's not like regular voting. People, 170,000 people went out and spent a lot of time on this and energy. What do we have to say to them?
Well, I think the result in Iowa, the lack of clarity and the lack of confidence that the votes were counted in a fair way is very troubling. But I don't think the solution is to disengage. The solution is to fight for better procedures. I mean, if I were a member of the Iowa Democratic Party, I would be raising hell right now. And, you know, if I were in the Iowa legislature, I'd be thinking about taking the caucus away from the Iowa Democratic Party. The Supreme Court has said that states can require parties to use primaries. I mean, I don't think Iowa would do it because then they get into a fight with New Hampshire as to who could go first. But we need to fight anytime we see election incompetence and say that our democracy demands better. And really, that's a big message in my book, which is that this is not a time for complacency. This is a time for activism where you need to push your election officials to make sure they have fair and transparent procedures and backup plans in case things go wrong, because there are outside forces that want things to go wrong. And this, in order to protect our democracy, it's worth putting in this kind of effort. So not a waste of time. Keep voting, keep showing up, and push for a better system so that we can preserve our democracy.
The book is Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. The author is Rick Hassan, who is a professor of law and political science at UC Irvine, who blogs on election law, writes for Slate, and a whole lot of other places. Rick, thanks so much for joining us. And congratulations on this unfortunately well-timed book.
Thank you very much. And your book is in my pile. So, you know, eventually we'll get a chance to read each other's books. And hopefully we can write about happier things in future books.
Indeed. Thanks so much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.